This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We expect Gary Wills to write about presidents. He is, after all, the author of books about Lincoln, Reagan, Nixon, and Kennedy. But his new book is a biography of John Wayne. There is a connection between Wayne and the presidents Wills has studied. Nixon used Wayne's movie Chisholm to explain his own views on law and order. And Wayne was a favorite of Ronald Reagan during his career as an actor and president. Wills' new book, John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity, isn't a conventional biography. It's more concerned with the image Wayne projected and the images projected onto him.
Here's a fellow who is appealed to by acting politicians, whether Gingrich or Reagan or Nixon or Kissinger, to explain their own values. And you ask them what they believe in, not simply in terms of what policy they're going to vote for today. They turn to Wayne and say, I believe in the Duke. And so I thought, this is a fellow who transcends the normal showbiz personality, obviously, and stands on the one hand with mythical figures and on the other hand with living political figures.
You point out that both Reagan and Wayne were from Iowa, but Wayne wanted to forget that, whereas Reagan mythologized it.
Yes, it's fascinating that the difference between the two. Here you have Wayne, a movie figure who became politically important, and Reagan, a politician as he ended up, who had been in movies. But they're quite different men. Their whole body language was different. Reagan was avuncular, our older brother, accommodating, very friendly, whereas Reagan was. But Wayne was very tough and the strong, demanding, paternal. And Ronald Reagan, of course, was a great Wayne fan and wanted to be Wayne. He left the studio and made himself an independent agent so he could put himself in Westerns, where he was never very good. But the only reason for that, as he said, was that John Wayne had ridden ahead with the cavalry banner.
You mentioned Newt Gingrich, too, is a big admirer of John Wayne. How does Wayne figure into the Newt mythology?
Well, his stepfather says that Newt saw Sans Viwa Jima three times in one day when he was a boy, and that he tried to walk like Wayne and talk like Wayne. And when Elizabeth Drew went to talk to Gingrich during the time when he shut down the government, she said, your own troops, your Republican supporters, are beginning to rebel. They're saying that the public is losing patience, we've gone too far. And he told Elizabeth Drew, I learned from Sergeant Stryker, Wayne's character in Sands of Iwo Jima, that you have to be tough on your own men for their own good. And he said that Sands of Iwo Jima was the formative movie in his life.
You write in your book that you're not writing a biography of John Wayne. You want to write basically about what John Wayne has symbolized, but you say in terms of his own life, he had no interesting ideas. Do you think he was a shallow man?
Well, I think he was not interested in politics as a subject to debate or consider. He had a political stance. He was not shallow in the sense that he was a hardworking professional who understood his business, and that was his main concern, and who cooperated with a number of creative people, writers and directors, publicists, to work on this mythic figure that he became. And he was careful not to destroy that image. He didn't want to do anything that would hurt it. Once he saw that it was the source of his appeal and of his resonance with the larger community, he was told, directors, for instance, Howard Hawks said, show fear in Red River. And he said, no, I won't do that. He said, I'll show concern. I'll show worry. I won't show fear. John Wayne doesn't show fear. And in The Shootist, Don Siegel said that he should shoot somebody in the back who's just shot him. And he said, no, John Wayne doesn't shoot people in the back. So he had thought very carefully about the things that were important to him.
The director, Raoul Walsh, is the person who changed John Wayne's name from his birth name, which was Marion Morrison. For which film did Raoul Walsh do this? And did he also changed the biography of John Wayne when he changed the name?
Yes, The Big Trail. Walsh found Wayne a property mover at the studio. He had done some bit acting, but he had not really acted in anything that mattered. And taking a huge chance, he took this man who had really no experience to count, and decided that he moved so well that he needed him. So he renamed him, he taught him to ride, changed his appearance, had his hair grow long, put him in very tight-fitting buckskins. So he created the first John Wayne, who's kind of naive at the social level, but very much attuned to nature and the Indians, who loves to live outdoors and stay away from civilization. And that figure Wayne lived with for 10 years or so, until until Howard Hawks changed him in Red River.
How did Howard Hawks change him in Red River?
Well, he changed him into the older figure. Wayne had actually been playing a man in his 20s when he was in his 30s, and now, late in his 30s, Hawk said, play a man in your 40s so we can have this younger person look up to you.
Montgomery Clift.
And Wayne was a little reluctant, as all actors are. They hate to admit their age and certainly to exaggerate their age. But it turned out to be a brilliant thing for Wayne, because once he was established in that role, he played it for all the cavalry pictures with Ford, and it allowed him to go on much longer than most actors, because he was no longer the person having to carry the love interest with a young, beautiful woman. He was this older father figure to whom the real love interest looked up.
I know one of your favorites of John Wayne's movies is The Searchers, directed by John Ford. And I really love this film, too. And I think an interesting thing about this movie in terms of John Wayne's image is that he spends the movie in pursuit of a relation of his, a white girl who's been kidnapped by the Indians, who was kidnapped years ago. And you know, he's obsessively pursuing her. At the end, after he restores her to her family, I think it's like the final shot, a very kind of famous shot, now when the door closes on his face. You know, the family's gathered, united again, and the door's closed on him, and he's like standing outside.
Yes, he's sealed out.
Yeah, which is such an interesting thing, considering how many, quote, like family values people have used John Wayne as their hero. And he's never a family man in movies. I mean, he might have a community, but the community is more likely to be the cavalry than a wife and children.
That's right. He's normally lost his wife in one way or another. She's died, or at the beginning of Red River, she's killed by the Indians, his fiancée is. In Rio Grande, she's left him. In Sands of Iwo Jima, she's left him. Sometimes his very professionalism has made the wife say, I can't put up with your being more a Marine or more a cavalry officer than a husband, not staying at home with the children, etc. So what he does is pick up these surrogate sons because he's lost his own son. And, of course, that's true of The Searcher, where he has the young boy who's after the Indian girl. But he's the outsider who has to take care of the community. That's often the picture. In Stagecoach, he's the prisoner who's manacled and crammed inside the stagecoach. But when the Indians attack, he climbs up on top of the stagecoach and swivels in all directions and protects the people inside. He's the outsider who protects the community inside.
My guest is Gary Wills, and after writing about presidents like Lincoln, Nixon, and Reagan, he's now written a book about John Wayne called John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gary Wills, and we're talking about his new book, which is called John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity. You say it was 1948 that John Wayne became a superstar, which is also the year he became a political activist. Doing what?
Well, he joined the Motion Picture Alliance for American Values that his friend Warren Bond had been part of. That was a group that was formed against the Hollywood establishment during the early days of congressional attempts to investigate communism in Washington. And in those early days, the industry as a whole, the guilds, the producers, the studio executives, all opposed any interference. They said, we're anti-communist, but we can handle our own. We will make sure there's no communist propaganda going out. Well, when the Cold War heated up after 1946-47, and the Hollywood Ten was indicted, people who were suspected of having been communists, and taken to Washington at a very dramatic public hearing, the studios did a complete about-face. they decided now it was much too dangerous to say, no, we won't cooperate with Congress. And they said, yes, we will cooperate. Well, during all that earlier time, Wayne had not done anything. But as soon as the studios made it safe for everybody now to say, yes, we're going to cooperate with Congress, then he became the president of the Motion Picture Guild, and he took credit for kicking people out of the country, as he put it. It's a funny thing. He said, we never blacklisted anybody. We just ran them out of the country, which seems like people would prefer to be blacklisted.
Was it during the period that he headed the Motion Picture Alliance that he was also specializing in World War II movies?
Well, 1949 is the great Sands of Iwo Jima, where he makes the most important World War II movie. So, that was the time when he was at the head of the anti-communists. And that really is a movie supposedly about World War II, but it's a Cold War movie.
In what respect?
Well, in the movies that were made about World War II in 48, 49, 50, you never really saw the enemy. The Japanese were not targets of hate or anything of that sort. What it was about was the fear and danger of men cracking, the tensions within the unit, and keeping up your nerve and retaining your discipline, which of course was much more the Cold War atmosphere of the time than the tremendous patriotic fervor and phobia about the enemies in the actual war films in the early 40s.
Run down just a list of some of John Wayne's better-known war movies.
Well, there aren't that many. Of course, there's Green Berets at the end. But during the war itself, he didn't make any tremendously important war movies. He made The Fighting Seabees, where he had a small role and lost the woman. He made films in which he doesn't show up for 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 30 minutes. He was not a big star then. Later on, at one point, he said that he stayed out of the army because he could do more for the war effort by making these war movies. He was confusing at the time when he could make very influential war movies like Sands of Iwo Jima with what he actually did during the war. Humphrey Bogart made many more important war movies than Ronald Reagan did. Than John Wayne did.
So what did he do during the war and why didn't he fight in it?
Well, he had made Stagecoach in 1939 after 10 years of making B movies. And he wanted to get out of B-movies, and he wanted to get out of Westerns, and he thought that his career was just opening up, and he didn't want to leave. And, of course, Ronald Reagan was in exactly that same situation. He had made King's Row after a series of B-movies. And so his career was opening up, and he didn't want to leave, but he did. He didn't go overseas because he was practically blind, but he was afraid that it would hurt his career to go into the military, and it did. His image was of the boy, friendly, best friend type, and he had aged beyond that by the end of the war. So he did sacrifice. And big stars who could have made a convincing plea that they were needed at home to make pictures, Jimmy Stewart, Clark Gable, people like that, did go into the military. But Wayne did not want to. And when you go and look at the correspondence that he had with John Ford, who was very gung-ho, very militaristic, serving in OSS and trying to get all his friends into the military, you see him write letters like, oh, I'm coming in after the next movie. And then he'll write and say, I have the papers, but I'm on location and I don't have a typewriter. or he says, I went off and left the papers with Ward Bond and he can't get Josie, his first wife, from whom he was being separated then, to give necessary documents, as if the military was really going to make it hard for John Wayne to get into the army. After he had made these various appeals and had been listed less than 1A, the draft board did list him 1A later in the war, and the studio begged for him to stay, and he was allowed to. Of course, Clark Gable could have made the same plea, but didn't. So it was entire careerism. He thought that his career was ready to take off, and he wasn't going to take a chance on coming back 5 years and seeing a whole wave of new young guys had come up, which, by the way, had happened. He didn't realize, of course, he'd be most appealing in his middle age persona.
One of John Wayne's war movies was The Green Berets, about the Vietnam War, based on a book by Robin Moore. that I was surprised to find out the Defense Department really hated.
Yes.
You know, this was like the big patriotic, you know, the Vietnam War is good movie, you know, an answer to all the critics. And so why did the Defense Department hate the book that the movie was based on?
Well, if you read the book, you're not surprised. It's really a collection of short stories, and it's about soldiers of fortune, a lot of them foreigners, not American, who are in the CIA for the fun of it and who love the perks of war, the sexual perks and torture and things that, of course, we were denying that we liked and that we were engaged in. So they wanted all of that removed, and, of course, most of it is in the movie. But they were very frightened of what could be made of that book.
Because the characters in it were depicted as very kind of sadistic, racist.
Yeah, and it was, yes, and it was contemptuous of the Vietnamese. It showed these soldiers of fortune kind of laughing at the people they were supposed to be helping.
My guess is Gary Wills, and after having written extensively about such presidents as Lincoln, Nixon, and Reagan, he's written a new book about John Wayne called John Wayne's America. I'm interested in talking to you a little bit about what's happening in the White House now, some of the controversy surrounding President Clinton. Let's look at some of the fundraising controversy, particularly what's surrounding the use of the Lincoln bedroom. Who has been a guest there during the Clinton administration? People are saying now that a lot of guests basically bought their way into the Lincoln bedroom. It was a favor in return for donating a lot of money. And I wonder what you think of this controversy.
Well, you know, if the law says you can't solicit on the federal property, and they did, then they broke the law. That's one thing. The idea that you don't give favors to people who give money to you is certainly something no politician I know of should be surprised at. Now, the need to go out and collect these vast amounts of money is obscene, and something should be done to stop that. The president himself said that he didn't have time for anything else but to drum up money. That's wrong, but we're not going to stop that by saying there's something sacred about the Lincoln bedroom and forget the rest of the influx of money. I'm fascinated by the people who say, the White House has never been used for such crass things. How short people's memories are. You know, Ollie North took group after group after group into the White House for briefings and high-level contacts to drum up money for the Contras, which was illegal money, secret money. It went into banks abroad. The White House was used for that. You know, this, it's not something whose sacredness has never been tainted before. And on Capitol Hill, lobbyists not only were invited in for special treatment after they had given money and were obviously in line to give money, they sat down and wrote the bills. Nobody is saying that Chinese people came into the White House and sat down and wrote the policy out for the president to carry down to the Hill. I think we've gone completely overboard on this whole sacredness of the White House business, especially the Lincoln bedroom. You know, they talk about that as if it's okay if you sleep in another room, you know, and if you just bunked out in the laundry room, that would be okay. But the Lincoln bedroom. Well, you know, Lincoln never slept there. And since the whole house was gutted when Harry Truman was president, you know, you have these wonderful pictures where it's just a shell. There's nothing. There's no room. There's no floors. That whole room was created in the 40s. So Lincoln never was in there. Never set foot in it, didn't lie in it. You know, the whole mystique and the idea that there's some sacrilege involved in letting people stay in the Lincoln bedroom is just silly.
If you were to try to get at what's really wrong with political fundraising, where would you look?
Well, Dick Morris is our clue. He went to Clinton and he said, they ran Harry and Louise ads and killed you on health care. You've got to fight back the way they do, with polls that tell you how to target your ads and then ads for legislative purpose, not just for campaigning. And Clinton bought that. Once you buy that, you are involved in continual polling and continual advertising of the most expensive sort.
I think you're describing quite a paradox here, that in order to you know, pass the legislation that you want to. You spend all this money on ads, and of course spending the money on ads means raising more money, which gets you more beholden to other people.
So the more
you try to put across your agenda with money, the more beholden you become to other people's agendas.
Exactly. You've got it.
Gary Wills, he's the author of the new book, John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.